She got up, brushing her jacket. Saturday? Saturday's a quietish day, okay? Fine, fine. Thank you. She turned abruptly, and I followed her tall, arrogant figure as she pushed and edged her way through the laughing and gesticulating people. At the door, she stopped, her hand on the brass latch. You know, I really wouldn't thank me if I were you. Remember that a key opens more than just a door, and on this trip, you won't find that you're opening a can of sardines, Buster. Think about it.
Jericho was written and read by Dirk Bogard, abridged by Neville Teller, and produced by Janet Whittaker. And on Monday, when William finally gets to meet Brent Miller, he finds out just why, as Martha puts it, a key opens more than a door.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Richard Hannay hunts the man who threatens both Britain and the love of his life in the 60-minute drama Mr. Standfast at 3 o'clock. First, as a 70s child, Emma Kennedy's summer holidays didn't mean the joy of centre parks or the sophistication of a Tuscan villa. They meant being crammed into a car with Grandma and heading to the coast, with just a tent for a home and a bucket for the necessities. In this final part of her memoir, the 13-year-old author takes her final camping trip en famille to France. The perils of sunburn are as nothing to the public humiliation that follows.
And he can see no reasons, cause there are no reasons. What reason do you need to be shown? Whoa, 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 whoa. Tell me why I don't like Mondays.
By 1979, everything had changed. A dark, miserable cloud of adolescence had descended, and I was engulfed by it. I was 13, delighted by nothing, awkward and moody. My parents, once my friends and playmates, were now the scratching posts for my misery. My mother, disgusted that Britain had turned Tory, was determined to return to France. At least they believe in equality. Aix-en-Provence was the town in the south of France where we had spent an inauspicious 24 hours 3 years previously. There was a vague recollection that the campsite had been wonderful, and so because my mother was determined to play it safe, it was decided that a return trip would be just the ticket. At first sight, my mother was right. In the blazing sunshine, Aix was a platter of delights. The campsite, where we had so briefly stayed, was just as impressive. Our pitch was at the top end of a slope, providing us with beautiful views to the north and south, surrounded by the smell of herbs, rosemary and thyme that grew wild all about us. Aix Market was a fairground of treats. Mum was in her element, wafting about in a floor-length white cotton Laura Ashley skirt with huge milkmaid pockets. "I feel well posh in this," she said, putting it on in the cramped confines of the tent. Ever mindful that French women were in a permanent state of immaculate presentation, she was keen to blend in. Her appearance, however, rather than melting her into the crowd, was having the opposite effect. A swarthy man, dressed in a Romany-style waistcoat and trousers, had peeled out from the crowd and, spotting my mother, made a beeline for her and grabbed her by the arm. He was dancing on the spot like a jester and had a parrot on one shoulder that kept bobbing up and down and squawking, "Bonjour! Bonjour!" My father, not believing what he was hearing, found the whole thing hilarious. "The parrot's speaking in French!" he yelled, shaking his head. The man with the parrot on his shoulder had started creeping round the circumference of the circle with a hat out, asking for money. Noticing that we were making a dash for it, the man scuttled over like a crab and hunched in front of my mother, held out the hat while gesturing towards her outfit. You see, he thinks you're rich or something, said Dad in something of a whine. I told you not to dress up. My mother, shooting my father a short but nonetheless withering glance, turned to the man and, holding her hands out, said, Pardon, monsieur, rien, rien. The man, who had been grinning and bowing, stopped what he was doing. His face, which had up till that point seemed jovial, clouded over, and a scowl as deep as the seas set in. Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out what seemed to be a jewelled chicken's foot. Lifting it into the air, he waved it three times and then tapped me on the forehead with it while emitting a disturbing hissing noise. Recoiling from having been touched by a dead chicken's foot, I let out a small noise to register my disgust, only to have the parrot, fixing me with its beady eyes, bob up and down in my direction and say, Tu es mort, mort, mort. I stared back. Did that parrot just tell me I was dead? I asked, turning to look at my father. Oh, my God, said my mother, clutching at my shoulder. They've just cursed Emma. Tony, do something. But it was too late. They had gone, swallowed into the crowd. So that was that. I was going to die. I'd grown up in the clutches of the capricious holiday gods, and now I'd been given a top-up curse by a green, evil-eyed cockatoo. I'd been through storms, sickness, and a multitude of close encounters with bodily fluids, but death was something else entirely. I needed to be on my toes. It was blisteringly hot, and we had driven on to the small seaside town of La Ciotat. The beach was relatively tiny and was nestled at the foot of some cliffs. It was just past noon, and my father, after carrying all our stuff down to the beach, left us to find a shop and bring back some lunch. Getting a suntan on holiday had, in previous years, been a byproduct of the experience rather than the raison d'etre. But now I had turned 13, it was all change. I wanted a tan, and I wanted it bad. Have you put cream on, Emma? Asked my mother. Yes, I said, lying. I hadn't put on one drop, not one. I wanted to lie very still and quietly bake until I had an angry red line that ran all the way across my bikini bottoms. When Dad returned, he had bought baguettes, tomatoes, a saucisson and a couple of cheeses. He was sweating profusely and wearing a frown that was deep and pained. My father was very fair-skinned, and his shoulders, exposed to the sun, had burnt and blistered in the short time he'd been walking. I wasn't just burning. I was cooking. My skin was a livid crimson and was giving off pulsing radioactive heat. I hadn't moved in about 2 hours, and so as my mother insisted that we all leave and return to the campsite, I was unaware of the full extent of the agony to come. Brenda was livid with the pair of us. I was starting to feel properly ill. I was dizzy and boiling. Was this, as the parrot predicted, the beginning of my end? As soon as first light was up, my parents, stricken with worry, carried me outside and lay me down in the shade of the Land Rover. I was lying on the floor on an airbed, and Meyer and Jurian, my two camp friends from Holland, had wandered over to stare at me, as had several of the campsite children, drawn by the attraction of the small, unfolding drama. "Are you sick?" Mia had asked. "Yes, she is," interjected my mother. "Don't stand too close, please. Give us some room." Everyone shifted backwards a few steps, but I was too interesting a spectacle to be left entirely alone. Mia's mother, a solid woman with a face like a bulldog, flip-flopped over. She was wearing an orange bikini and stood hand on one hip, giving me the once-over. Back in Holland, she began, speaking to my mother, I am a nurse. Would you like me to take a look at her for you? My mother, delighted to be in the hands of a professional, readily agreed. I think we should take her temperature, I heard Mia's mother saying. This way we know how bad the fever is. I will fetch my things. There was a lull in the proceedings. There were at least 15 people now gathered at the base of our pitch, all of them staring at me, some of them with their arms crossed, others holding towels and wash bags, but all of them fascinated. Mia's mother returned. She was holding a small green plastic box in one hand. As she unhooked the catch, she said, So, I take the temperature now. With one deft manoeuvre, she shook the thermometer in one hand and flipped me onto my belly with the other. I didn't quite understand what was happening, but suddenly my bikini bottoms were being pulled off me. She was taking my temperature rectally, in front of strangers. The words of the parrot rang in my ears. "To Imot," it had squawked. "To Imot." As I lay, thermometer sticking up out of my anus for all to enjoy, a calm descended. This was it. This was my final moment. Death was now only moments away. I was a 13-year-old girl with a thermometer in my bum hole. I didn't want to go on living. I could never face the world again. "Yes," said Mia's mother, slipping out the offending instrument and reading it. "She is very hot. She needs to see a doctor." "Thank you so much," said my mother, touching the woman lightly on the forearm. "Thank you? Thank you for what? Destroying my life as I knew it?" Only my father, my dear, sweet father, understood what had just happened. Quietly and without making a fuss, he crept up and pulled the bikini bottoms back to where they should have been. The doctor was very good-looking, all floppy black hair and lazy brown eyes. "When did this begin?" he asked, accent like silk. "Yesterday," explained my mother. "She had a bit too much sun and she swam in the sea." "Boof," puffed the doctor, raising his eyebrows. "You swim in the sea? This is not such a good idea. So, now I take your temperature." "No!" I yelled, managing to sit up. I even put my hands underneath me. "The doctor will take your temperature the normal way, Em," said my dad, taking a step towards me and folding his arms. He looked ridiculous, but at that moment, he was my only hope. "Can you take her temperature in the mouth, please?" he added, fixing the doctor with a manly stare. I was running a temperature of 102 degrees. The doctor, who had diagnosed me as having something that sounded like la grippe, had handed my parents a prescription as long as your arm. 6 medicines had been recommended: a cream for my sunburn, an anti-inflammatory for my sunburn, a post-blister ointment for my sunburn, pills for the fever, an antiemetic pill in case I felt nauseous, and a mystery bonus pill that we couldn't quite recognise. "This last thing?" asked my father. "What is it?" "A suppository," said the doctor. "You administer it into the anus." My father shot me a quick look. "No chance. No chance whatsoever." And so the holiday gods had had their final laugh. On the one holiday that had promised to be so enjoyable, I spent the remainder of our time in the shade and sleeping. Hours were meaningless, days indistinguishable. My childhood holidays weren't going out with a bang. They were drifting quietly away to a dry and deadened end. Every last scrap of joy had been sucked out of me. I was ready to be a teenager. It was a warm, late summer evening. I was about to go back to school and had been lying in a hammock at the bottom of the orchard. "I'm thinking of having a bonfire," Dad said, giving the hammock a gentle swing. "What for?" asked Mum, squinting towards the low sun. "Haven't got anything to burn." "Yes," said Dad, picking up a long blade of grass and twisting it round his finger. "We have. I want to burn the tent." I ran round the garden with a wheelbarrow, ferreting under trees and breaking off dead branches. Dad had broken up a few old planks he'd found in the garage and was making a pyre-like structure on a disused vegetable patch. The tent, still in its blue canvas bag, was placed on top of the unlit bonfire. We'd been dogged with ill fortune and disaster. The tent had to die. Dad, wanting to make sure it burnt, got a can of lighter fluid and tipped the whole lot over it until the air was filled with fumes. "Right," he said, pulling out a box of matches from his pocket. "That should do it." "Wait," I shouted. "We've forgotten something." I ran off to the garage. I knew what I had to do. "The bucket," I yelled, clattering back with the pink plastic devil tucked under my arm. "We've got to burn the bucket." With one toss, the bucket rotated high into the air and then fell, landing squarely on top of the blazing tent. The destruction was immediate. The bucket, overwhelmed by heat and flames, imploded, contorted plastic shapes collapsing in on themselves until solid form gave way to liquid. "Ooh, that was good," said my dad, impressed. We all nodded. a terrible burden had been lifted. "Next year," I said, as we all walked back up the garden, "can I bring a friend on holiday?" "If you want," said my mother, putting an arm around my shoulders. "Mind you," she added, looking back at the still-burning tent, "what are we going to do now?" "Anything we want," said my dad. And you know what? I believed him.
The Tent, the Bucket and Me was written and read by Emma Kennedy. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters.
Listen now to the sound of superiority!
Hello!
Extracted from the archives of comedy and gilded in gold.
League Against Tedium in the area.
Simon Munnery.
In the area.
Thought. The truly beautiful are often abused for apparent ugliness, just as those with great vision often bump into things.
The League Against Tedium.
Oh, I do apologise. Apologise.
On Radio 4 Extra, in Thursday night's Comedy Club at 11.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, Jim Lee here with this afternoon's 60-minute drama. David Robb and Clive Merrison are the stars as Richard Hannay hunts the man who threatens both Britain and the love of his life. The weekend is looming, and in the 4 o'clock show, Mel will be settling down with a nice cup of tea and hearing about travels around China to source the stuff. And later, can the poet Paul Hamilton end a midlife crisis on holiday with his girlfriend? Kevin Eldon and Lisa Tarbuck star in Hamilton's Odyssey in the Comedy Club tonight at 11. Now, the second and final part of the World War I spy thriller Mr. Standfast, written by John Buchan and dramatised by Bert Cools. The action moves to France as Richard Hannay and British agent Mary Lamington attempt to track down a German spy.
Walter, this man Ivory is a genius in disguise. He can become anyone. He can fool anyone. Heaven alone knows how many top-level meetings he's been to.
Well, if he has learned anything crucial, he's not passed it on yet. Well, we'd know if he had, believe me. Now we can pick him up, and he'll never have the chance. Yes, excellent work, Dick.
I'm afraid not.
What do you mean?
When I recognized him, I must have given myself away. He realized what had happened. I saw it in his eyes.
He knows we're onto him.
And if I'm any judge, right now he'll be heading straight for Berlin with enough classified information to change the entire course of the war. Dear God, Walter, what have I done?
Mr. Standfast by John Buchan. Dramatized by Bert Cools. Episode 2.
In the past, I'd always come back to my old Park Lane flat with a great feeling of comfort. I liked to see my hunting trophies on the wall and sink into my own armchair. But not this time. Listen, Ivory's involved with two organizations, the Caged Birds and the Wild Birds. Does that mean anything to you?
Not a thing. Mary?
I'm afraid not.
All right. What about this name? Bommerts.
Bommerts. Sounds Dutch. No, I'm sorry.
No. Well, but at least it gives us something to work with. I'll put my people onto it.
Good man. Now, we have to think about his blind spot.
What do you mean?
It's one of old Peter's theories. Every living creature has its blind spot. Doesn't matter how clever it is or how alert. There's always one source of danger that it just can't see.
Find that one spot, and you've got cover better than any bush or rock. And then, Dick, you move in for the kill.
And I'll tell you just what Ivory's blind spot is. It's me. I'm the one person in the world he can't fool with his disguises.
But he did fool you at first.
Because I wasn't looking for him then. I'm on my guard now. I'll always be able to recognise him. I can't explain why, but I know I'm right.
Excellent, excellent. And that's not his only weakness.
Oh?
When you saw him in that tube station, you said he was terrified. Huh?
Good Lord, that's right. How the deuce could I have forgotten?
Well, he's obviously not a man who scares easily, so this must be some fundamental flaw, a soft spot in his brain that something about the air raid triggered. Now, let's see, the air raid, the crowd, the noise, confined space. It's hard to know, but it's something to bear in mind, even if we can't make use of it. It proves he's not invincible.
Well said.
I might have something.
My dear?
I think I caught a glimpse of the real man too, the man behind the mask.
Yeah? When was this?
Last week. His face didn't change, but suddenly, just for a moment, he wasn't Moxon Ivory anymore. He was someone deeper, more real.